These are the droids you're looking for.
Over here!
Death Star alert.
You're looking for.
This is madness.
It blew my mind when I read about it.
No, it's 100% going to be the best film in the franchise.
This is madness.
Star Wars is only now starting.
Did you hear that? Did you hear that?
These are the droids you're looking for.
Did you hear that? Did you hear that? You talking about
these are the droids you're looking for. I felt nauseous with just pure excitement.
These are the droids you're looking for.
Why isn't it December 15th already?
And then I saw the Porg for the first time speaking. And I'll tell you what, it really whets the appetite.
These are the droids you're looking for.
This is madness.
Welcome back to the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Alongside Chris, Ryan, and Sam, I am Mike. And guys, thrilled to be back to be talking about the special features of The Last Jedi. It is available on digital, soon to be available on Blu-ray as well. There were so many features packed into this. The documentary, the director, and the Jedi being the highlight of it. It was so much fun to dive in, and at one point I found myself rewatching moments over and over again, especially that documentary. I've watched it at least 2.5 times so far, and I look forward to watching it another 3 to 5 times in the next few weeks. It was an incredibly well-done documentary, and unlike what we had seen from a lot of other films in terms of making-of documentary, and that's because of Rian Johnson and Ron Bergman, the two of them wanting this to be documented in a different way. It was really excellent, and I was pleasantly surprised at how much insight there was into the movie.
It was... I would say it's the best behind the scenes documentary I've seen. It's like supplemental material. You know, it's like the other thing would be like Hearts of Darkness, you know, but that's like a feature film.
I would pay for that as a separate movie. If they had released that to say like, oh, here's a separate movie about Star Wars, I would have bought it on iTunes.
Oh, yeah. And Nicole and I were watching it and we were like this because it ends at the end of production. And I was like, I want to see post-production. I want to see the entire thing.
Yep.
The only thing I can think of that kind of competes with it is on the Clerks 10th anniversary DVD. There was like a 2-hour documentary about the making of it. But that was also like a retrospective about 10 years of a movie.
Right.
By the way, shout out to my man, Kevin Smith, who had a heart attack 2 weeks ago and has been crushing it since. He's been on like 98 podcasts. Just saying. Shout out to Kev.
Wow. Yeah, it gave him strength.
It did. This was an amazing documentary. It was really insightful. I was amazed with how like honest it was. It seemed, at least.
Rachel and I watched it a few nights ago. I finally I was waiting to buy the movie on the disc, you know, Blu-ray plus digital version, so I could have all the platforms, but
all the fixins.
But Chris all the fixins. But Chris convinced me at a bar to buy it on my phone. So I did that, and the next night Rachel and I actually watched together, because she loved this movie in theater so much. Like, she's not normally one for we don't actually watch a ton of movies together. She's more of a TV person, but like, she loved this movie, and she was like, oh, I'd be really interested to see. I thought Rian Johnson in the interviews I saw with him seemed really cool, and like, I think the two things, like the two sort of top level comments I have coming out of it are like just about the two main players, which is that like Rian Johnson is incredible. I found like how sensitive he is to both character and fan was like so fulfilled. Like, the trust I placed in him was like confirmed. And then the other top level thing was, I was like, oh my God, that producer does so much work.
Oh,
like,
my God.
I cannot believe the amount of, like, you hear about producers in Hollywood, and like, it's very easy to picture like sort of like the fat cats with like the big, you know, big purse strings sort of being like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll kick a few million your way. Go make it.
And their car phones.
With their beepers and car phones and their Rolodexes full of names.
Gordon Gecko.
But the real Gordon Geckos of the West Coast. But like, this guy, I was just like, oh, this guy is a truly like creative partner and like a workhorse. Like, he's in the trenches every day.
Oh my God.
I was fascinated by what's his last name? Ron Bergman.
Bergman.
They're just like, they're buddies. They're two friends that just are making a Star Wars movie. Like,
well, I wish I had that.
Rian Johnson came across as such like an atypical type of director, or just like an atypical person for the industry. Like, he was so just like pleasant and nice and like
He's such like a delightful nerd. Like,
if you were to put all those people in like a lineup, and you'd say like, which one's the film director? And I mean this in a nice way. Like, you wouldn't point to him.
Right.
No, he doesn't seem cutthroat. I'm sure that he has aspects of him that are cutthroat, but he's very endearingly awkward. Like, he's very like, his humor sometimes in the documentary is kind of like dad humor.
Right.
The way he like reacts to people. He's just like this very endearing person,
mm-hmm.
and seems genuinely sweet. But speaking to the amount of work that like the production team does, there's a scene in the documentary where they start making the schedule,
mm-hmm.
where they're just looking at like calendars being like, we have 100 days. Like, where do we start? And it's genuinely anxiety inducing.
Oh, I got super stressed, and I like paused it and I turned to Rachel and I was like, this is probably the most like stressed I get on a day-to-day basis in my job, which I do marketing for a theater in New York. And, you know, the most stressed I get is whenever we're trying to set like a press meeting or a marketing meeting with like some of the creative team and our press reps and everything. And like, my boss will like email me and be like, hey, Sam, can you schedule this meeting? And I'm talking about like six people, mm-hmm. and one meeting. And right. it's open to like any time in the next 2 weeks. And I need to like go like take a pill and sit down, you know, like I like cannot handle it. So the idea of just looking at that raw amount of data, it was so impressive to me. And the way that, you know, the good humor that he seems to share, he seems to have that along with Rian Johnson, that like, at least now, of course, I'm sure this documentary shows everybody in a more flattering light. But like, even Ron Bergman did not seem to be a person who was easily flappable, you know, like he seemed to keep his cool.
There were parts in this documentary that I was concerned that they weren't going to finish the movie. I was like, oh no, what are they going to do? I think that was in one of the Empire special features. They mentioned how like at the time Empire and Return of the Jedi were like at that time, the most difficult movies to make, like they were near impossible movies and feats to make technically. And I'm wondering, given the budget of this, and just like, if you're given the option to like, well, we could build the real set for 2 days, and then if you have that budget, you say yes, right? Like, I feel like, but then that puts you into this weird realm where like everything becomes exponentially more difficult. And so I'm going to just make a theory that this might be the most difficult movie ever made.
Oh, I mean, I think it was like, I enjoyed the other side of that coin too. Whenever you sort of referred, Chris, to like, oh, whenever you have the budget to like build something or to do something. But I actually really enjoyed also like the sort of honesty of like, everyone kind of laughed and said like, look, we know that we were extremely privileged to have, you know, the full weight of Disney behind us and a huge budget. But when the expectations and the script and the story you're trying to tell is this big and the expectations are this high, that budget is still a budget and you're still mm-hmm. constrained by it. And,
sure.
you know, it's sort of like the idea of like the need rises to meet the challenge or the tools or whatever.
No one ever has enough time or enough money.
Right. And I think I just enjoyed the fact that like nobody was acting as though this were like so difficult that they barely like they were pinching pennies, but they also acknowledged the fact that it was like, well, we did have to make choices, you know.
Right.
There were scenes that, you know, Rian really wanted to do either A, on location, or he had different locations. And just from a logistics and budget mm-hmm. standpoint, you know, we had to see where we could combine things. Could it be set in this place? And it was like, oh God, I never even think about that. Like we like it, and it kind of tied it again to a little bit, like it made it in a small way relatable to me in my job, where it's like, I do know what it's like to like decide, I not me, but like when our organization decides to produce a script of a young, you know, of a playwright, and then like the sort of production decisions that start to dictate like certain choices that you make along the way. And it was just like, man, even on Star Wars, they got to do that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. It brought it back home.
There were times watching it, though, where they were like, all right, Ryan, we can just do this on green screen, or we could fly the entire crew out to Iceland.
Yeah.
And I was like sitting there being like, just do it on green screen, man. Yeah. Like, just like, it must be so tempting to just difficult. Be like, everyone well, would be so much happier.
Yeah.
If I just said, let's do it on green screen.
The way they talk about that island, too, they're like, it's difficult to get to. Like, they're saying that it's hard to even just go there and stand. Like, and now they're like, yeah, we're going to film a movie and we have to build a set on it.
I was honestly,
you need to, everything that you need for that set, you know, we're going to get to you by helicopter. Right. You know, the right. most difficult mode of and dangerous mode of transportation exactly. that exists.
Well, yeah, it's like.
To be fair, they did build that set on a cliffside in Ireland, not actually at Skellig Michael, because they couldn't film on Skellig Michael only for two days at a time. So they built the whole set, and they still had everybody on the cliffside that they had to protect by wiring them up and flying things in on a helicopter. I loved watching the, what was it, Space Sea Cow or whatever it was that he drinks the milk from, flying in, and that you could still see its flippers inside whatever covering it had on the helicopter.
What an insane, just dangerous thing just to have a sea cow sitting there in real life. It's beautiful. It was beautiful.
Worth all the effort.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
I was shocked for a Disney, you know, usually these kind of like things that come with the special features on something this big, like with Disney behind it, is usually just like, it was such an honor to be able to serve the fans.
Yeah.
Like things like that are like every day safe. Was a pleasure.
It's
but
very
like
safe.
I thought again, and I'm sure there's a ton of stuff we didn't see, but like there's one big thing that we're going to talk about. And then like just a small thing, which is like, there's a moment halfway through this movie where like seemingly on a very long lens where he doesn't really know he's being filmed. Rian Johnson is talking to Ron Bergman, like a dude just talking to his friend who he's known since he was 17, being like, I think I screwed up, man. Like, I don't know if this is going to work.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I don't know if this is working. Does it make sense? We're going to have to cut all this.
And Ron Bergman being like, yeah, I don't, like, in a talking head being like, you know, you have to make him feel confident, but also, you know, highlight that you can't really do much anymore. Like, it was just really fascinating.
Yeah, it was all about like managing the expectations of like your friend and colleague in this instance. And Mike, I thought I had when we were talking about the sea cow, the space cow. I did want to say, Mike, like the documentary, like not verbatim, but essentially, like I thought it was really cool that Rian Johnson almost said like what you said, which is like Star Wars is weird and I like being weird with Star Wars, because they were really commending him, and that effects guy who did the sculpts and stuff was basically saying like Rian really got his finger like on the pulse of like that sort of like Lucasian weirdness. And it took me right back to our conversations and like when we talked about specifically that moment in the film on our like reaction pod. And I was just like, yeah, Mike, you nailed it. That's exactly what it is. It's that weirdness.
That's how I was feeling again. And I was like, oh my gosh, they got it right. They really did understand that's what we wanted. And Rian understood that. And that was so special to hear that.
Yeah. To hear him say that. That's pretty amazing.
It's been such a pleasure being able to like watch this movie over and over again.
Yeah.
Cause it's like so rich. Yep. And like, I loved it when it came out, but like, boy, oh boy, do I love this movie.
It's also,
hang on. Rian, I think two other people here are going to be moving a movie up their list after they watch this a few more times.
Ooh. I think so too.
Well, when I do actually get around to watching it a second time.
Yeah.
Because I'm the worst. I'm feeling so like my cheeks are red right now, but I've still only seen it the one
Sam's
time.
About to ask us not to spoil anything.
I'm gonna put the making of ahead of The Last Jedi. I'll put the making of ahead of it. I also think this is a good documentary because it's a very clean movie, like just effects wise, whatever. Like it's just very well put together. And I think you kind of lose what's real and what's CG sometimes in this film. And I was surprised about the amount of effects that were actual stunts. Like when he jumps across that thing, to name one, like when Luke jumps across that valley or whatever, I did not know that he was really doing that.
Well, it's so funny. That's why I was saying to Nicole, like when they were like, we could do this practically or CGI. And he's like, we got to do it practically. I wanted to be like, I thought it was CGI anyway. You should have made your life easier.
I don't think that's ever happened in a movie where it looks so unbelievable that I was like, oh, it's definitely CGI.
Oh, like the scene with Yoda and the tree on fire. I was like, of course that's CGI. Like, why would it not be?
Yeah, and then it wasn't. There was like they did that test where they're like, yeah, we have to blow up this tree. So they built the whole set.
And then put it on fire.
I was like, all right, at this point, it's a little ridiculous.
Do you guys love Chris Corbould though too? Like as soon as I saw him, I said to Rachel, I was like, oh, I think that's Chris Corbould, because I think I first knew his name from like the Nolan films, but then I also like got real into his work because he's done all the late Bond films, and like the guy's just like a master of like the practical stunt, and he just knows how to like, I don't know, that's just so impressive to me in such a specific realm. But like the fact that he's doing these movies, I was like, no wonder all this real stuff like tricked me and looks incredible.
Yeah.
I think it's time that we get to one of the big points of this documentary, or at least big takeaways. And Ryan, I knew you were kind of leading to it, and I believe we're all talking about the same thing. Mark Hamill and Mark
hates
Hamill.
This movie.
Yeah. he seemed to hate it in production, but we also have to remember, the documentary was great, but the documentary also is trying to sell a narrative. And the narrative that they were trying to sell was that Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker was not on board, and not only was he not on board, it was creating a deep sadness in him that permeated his entire experience on the film. Yeah. At least that's what we saw in this.
Right.
And that made me very sad, and it also,
There are three unbearably sad moments in this movie that I will never be able to unsee. Okay. The first one is Mark Hamill doing the scene with R2-D2 where he can't get off the ground after.
Oh,
and Ryan Johnson has to go and like rub his back and just like let him have that moment.
Yep.
The second is when Ryan Johnson goes over to Mark Hamill, tells him what the name of the movie is going to be. When he says, I'm just telling you, I haven't told anyone yet, it's The Last Jedi. And Mark Hamill goes, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so earnest, so sad. And the third was when an extra in Canto Bite doesn't know who Mark Hamill is and has what I can only describe as the saddest interaction I've ever seen two human beings have in my life.
Oh, I didn't feel that.
I read the last one totally different.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, Mark Hamill is real sweetheart about it. I'm not saying he was.
No. I'm gonna challenge you to watch it again
Sam, I'm gonna challenge you to watch The Last Jedi again.
Throwing. If you have any challenges to the cast of the Droid Heads here, just email them our way. We accept your challenges.
I'm gonna be up till 3.
Sight unseen.
I'm gonna be up till 3 tonight watching it. But no, here's how I actually took that final scene. I was actually gonna bring that up as like a counterbalance that I found that scene incredibly touching, because I thought that the guy on Canto Bight, his vision was obscured by his mask, and I thought he bumped into Mark Hamill, and I thought he was saying like, "Oh my God, I didn't know it was you. I didn't know." Like, I thought he did recognize Hamill, but only late, and was like amazed. Did I read that wrong?
But Sam, you just said his vision. We've been talking about so many directors and things. I was just like, oh, that extra's vision of what the scene should have been.
No, Sam, I am with you. I think like he obviously realized who Mark Hamill was in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or in that moment,
Star Wars.
No, I'm saying that he previously, because he goes up and he goes, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize who you were.
Yeah,
and Mark Hamill's like, it's cool, man, like, don't worry about it. And he's like, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. Like,
he almost sat down on Luke Skywalker.
I get what you're saying. I thought
an awkward conversation.
Saying he never caught on,
no,
or something.
He totally does.
That would have been tragic if he's just like, what's this?
Yeah, so I, sorry, okay. We can cut this out. This is a pointless little.
But why, Ryan, do you feel sad for Mark Hamill in that? Because as you said, he's very friendly and nice.
I don't. Oh, okay. I don't feel sad.
The heartbreak of the scene. It's just cringeworthy.
It's so painful.
I don't know why they kept that in. That
I remember, exactly. I was like, I wish they had cut this out. I came and see it.
I remember, you know, reading it, the stuff that really hit me hard. I want to talk more about Mark Hamill, but like the stuff that hit me hardest was you know that I had read in maybe it was the Vanity Fair coverage or something where Rian Johnson was really talking about his relationship to Carrie Fisher and how like he found her like not just like a joy to work with like as an actor, but like writing wise, she had so much that she shared with him. And I felt like there were so many moments that the documentary really highlighted like their kinship. Like he seemed to be friendly with all the actors, but he seemed to like latch on to Carrie in a special way. And that like, I was like a mess watching this.
It felt the same way that like Oscar Isaac and Carrie had that same kind of relationship in the Force Awakens special features. Like it felt very similar. Like there's just certain personality types that get it. And Rian Johnson is one of those.
Yeah. And she seems like a tough one to get, honestly. Like, you know, like it just like it seems like, man, what would bring this guy?
Yeah.
Like the quiet nerd, but like seemingly just like, I don't know. It's just, he has such a different world.
Also, I was surprised. There were some very intense scenes that he was directing. And then he was just like telling like jokes while he was doing it.
Oh yeah. He almost made her laugh.
Yeah. It's like that's the best environment that they could possibly have. Like no intern or PA is like afraid of messing something up because he'd probably be like, oh, it's cool. Let's just do it again. We have $200 million.
Carrie Fisher is featured very briefly in a talking head talking about Rian Johnson.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up as well.
In those few moments, I mean, she was just the coolest.
Mm-hmm.
She's just so funny and so brilliant.
What does she say? She's like, he's an asshole.
Then she says, I'm just kidding. He has no flaws that I am aware of, but that just means he has them in other places.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, everything she said, she undercut him like three times while giving him the greatest compliment. Like it was so good.
She was the coolest.
So, to go back, I do think we need to go back to Mark Hamill, though.
And I want to say,
do you think his opinion has changed since the filming of the movie, since the press tour, since the movie has come out? I know he's always said that he was going to execute the vision. It's not his character, like he said in the documentary, even though he disagreed. Do you think, I haven't seen anybody in all of the different Q&As ask him if, after seeing the final film, has his opinion changed, and does he think that Rian made the right choice?
I think the only thing that's changed between them filming and now is that his PR team got involved.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, I think he ultimately liked it. I think he's just that kind of person that is rabble-rousing. Like, by the end of the movie, he had come around and said, I followed his vision or something to that extent, and now I understand what he was trying to do.
He said, you know,
I've only watched it once.
If this works and people love it, you know, that's not me. That's all on Rian. But, you know, if it doesn't, if people hate it, so is that. That's like the greatest. Like, I actually, Mike, this is the exact question I wanted to get to. And I genuinely, like, don't know. I think probably his opinion has probably changed, but it's probably like internally, I think it's probably a conflicted opinion because I think that he still probably doesn't like the choices that Rian Johnson made. But I do think that Mark Hamill is like, I think he's an actor. I think he likes the attention and I think he likes the praise.
I think the fact that
everyone has basically said, oh, Hamill's back. This is the best of his career. He steals the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is probably more than any narrative or plot or story reasons what will potentially sway him to say, yeah, we really got it right ultimately.
And here's the thing, no matter what Mark Hamill thinks about this movie, you know, what's abundantly clear is like my boy cares. Like he cares about it. This isn't like almost to the point that it's like almost like unbecoming at a certain point. Cause it's like we're I think it's great that he cares, don't get me wrong, but we're used to this like Harrison Ford, like, yeah, I guess I'm here. Like this disconnected, like Mark Hamill seems to care about it the way we like care about
it. Well, I think yes and no. And I also think that was like, you know how Harrison, that was always like, I told him they should have killed Han Solo. Like that was his press line. This was Mark Hamill's press line. And it was always like, I disagree with it. I think he's doing that because
that's a good point.
I think he's selling the movie that way to say, I disagree. He's also said in interviews, like this one's like unlike anything we've ever seen before in Star Wars. And so like, I think he's hyping that up quite a bit. I think it was very smart of Disney in the documentary to address it head on, because if they had not at all, it would have been very awkward. But well, I think
I felt like it was a little thesis.
I want to know if they filmed those talking head interviews after everything was done and he said those statements.
I thought it was a little heavy-handed. Is what I was going to say. Like I thought the Disney there was no scene of, you know, Rian Johnson and Mark Hamill like discussing that relationship they didn't hammer home the fact that, well, Mark didn't agree initially, but he executed. And ultimately it was like, okay, we get it.
Yeah. I feel like they filmed those after that interview came out, after that controversy came out. I think they filmed those interviews and said, say this, and we'll use this as the thesis of this documentary.
I guess I'm just very easily gullible because I bought into it. I didn't think that it was. I really didn't think that it had been made after the fact or that they were trying to compensate for anything. I do want to say Sam's point though. He's an actor. He wants to be in the limelight. I also think that this has to do with age a bit as well. He knows this is the end for him and this character. He didn't want to see. He thought that he had at least until 9 for his character to be killed off. So he would have 2 more movies to embody the role, 2 more movies to be on the press tour, to be one of the big focuses of all of this. And he's coming to grips with aging and coming to grips with the fact that he's no longer the main protagonist of a story when, you know, for him, for the majority of his life, he was the main part of Star Wars that everybody associated with Star Wars. It's Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. And now that's gone.
It could have been, that's it could the have shocking been thing. 3 movies. Like he probably thought there was 3 movies.
Just kind of like 4 words. 4 words. J.J. Abrams, time travel.
He's coming back as a Force ghost for at least one scene. We know.
Well,
that.
the thing that I was actually shocked is that there's a scene in the documentary where Ron Bergman says, again, very candidly, he's like, Mark thought that Luke Skywalker would be the Luke Skywalker of this trilogy.
Yeah.
But he's not. And like that, I was like shocked to hear because I was like, why would he think that? But
because he's always been that.
Yeah, and you know what? It's interesting because we've seen a lot in the reaction that specifically like old men, like middle-aged men, like men over 40 and 50 have had to this movie, which is like vehement anger about how Luke Skywalker was treated.
Yep.
You know, like why would they do this? I had a conversation with someone at my office where he was like, he was very angry. He was like, I hate this movie. They had a Star Wars movie with Luke freaking Skywalker and they blew it. And I was like, that's how you feel about this? Mm-hmm. Also, Luke Skywalker has been in every single Star Wars movie that Luke Skywalker was alive for. So it's not like a huge get to like get like he was right. Like, you had Luke Skywalker in a Star Wars movie. It's like, well, yeah.
But no, like I think
Mark Hamill is part of that demographic as well of like what he thought Luke Skywalker was versus what the movies actually made Luke Skywalker to be.
Yeah.
Maybe. Well, and I think of all the cast members of the originals. I mean, I do think that Hamill was the most, I think he had still the most engagement with the life beyond that original trilogy. Like I'm not saying that I think he was sitting at home reading every, you know, every extended universe novel.
Mark, if you're listening, let us know.
But I do think he followed the mythos, and certainly he was like aware of like via social media and the internet, you know, in that era, he's been aware of what people in meaning the fan base assumed was Luke's path after. And up until we actually got The Force Awakens, the path of Luke Skywalker was to reestablish the Jedi Order and the new temple and train a new legion of Jedi and to become a wizened old man who, you know, was a great leader and always a hero and always altruistic and righteous. And, you know, what they did, you know,
to
the
be
choices
a boring story.
Made.
His life choices, was to be a boring story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The choices made when they initiated this new trilogy, whether it was what Lucas intended or not, the decisions that you know, Kathleen Kennedy and Disney made, and J.J. Abrams when he got the, you know, handed the first baton, mm-hmm. was to say, it's about a new generation. We're going to introduce new heroes that are hopefully as compelling as those originals. And as soon as you make that decision, well, it's not about Harrison, Carrie, and Mark anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think that is more what Ron Bergman was responding to when he's saying Mark really thought this was going to be the Luke Skywalker that we knew.
Yeah,
right. I think he's talking about before any of them got involved. And it was
it's
a reasonable expectation, maybe.
It's interesting when you look at how J.J. handled Harrison Ford, or Han Solo, rather. It's kind of like we saw an arc with Han Solo where he was the smuggler that was just in it for the money and he was going to leave and he came back. So it's like we already got his arc. Like we already knew what he's about. So going into Force Awakens, he was a little bit of a recluse. Like what was his deal? Was he just vagabonding around in space by himself? Like he's
looking for the Falcon.
He went back to the only thing he was ever good at.
Right. So I think
hauling Raptors.
Right. Hauling Raptors. Oh, we're hauling Raptors.
Well, we're going to get to see soon enough that that's where it all started for him.
Right. But I'm just trying to think why weren't people upset at his introduction and then soon death in Force Awakens? Was it just because it was the same character, essentially?
Yeah, because he was making the same quips. He felt exactly the same. And that was part of what I liked about it, but it didn't need to be the case for every character.
Right.
Yeah, and interesting. And Sam, I think it's interesting what you said about Mark Hamill's knowledge of Luke Skywalker after the mm-hmm. trilogy. Because I've heard him in interviews on television say the words Mara Jade.
Yeah.
Like, he knows who Mara Jade
is.
I guarantee you that Harrison Ford has never heard the names Jason and Jaina Solo in his life. Like, he would have no idea what you were talking about.
Somebody's yelled at him in a crowd at one point, I'm sure, but he doesn't remember.
No, but that doesn't mean mean he knows those names.
I think that what Rian Johnson did was, and we've talked about this a lot, but he took, I think, what ended up being the surprising yet inevitable path in this, which is if you look at these characters and the journey they took. You know, when in the original trilogy, Luke was supposed to be, you know, in his early 20s, mm-hmm. right? And Han maybe in his late 20s or whatever. But, you know, this is 20 or so years later. And if you look at the real trajectory of life, people that you knew then, you mm-hmm. know, have this big impact on you. You will always be connected. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're the same people or you're hanging out every day or mm-hmm. that your relationships don't evolve or that you don't evolve. Like, Luke went through a terrible ordeal with a family member.
Yeah.
Han and Leia, assumedly, I don't know if they were married, but they split up. You know, it's families kind of mm-hmm. Get distant that way. It just seems like a much more rich approach. Yeah. While I love The Force Awakens, I feel like The Last Jedi is such a more rich approach. And I think that this documentary really highlights that and where Rian Johnson's head was at with it.
Sure.
I want to touch on some of the other things we haven't gotten to yet. So I want to mm-hmm. go around, have one other favorite moment that you had from the documentary. I'll start with is Yoda and Frank Oz. And seeing the way that they recreated the puppet, that they even had Neil Scanlon kind of make a video with his team mm-hmm. of, hey, we can do this, and we're thrilled to have you coming back, Frank Oz. And then to build that whole set so that he could puppeteer that, and then to watch Mark Hamill be taken back when he heard him saying young Skywalker, and it was just beautiful, and I loved it, and I love Yoda even more every moment I see something like this.
Yeah. I have to say my favorite scene of that, and I think it just is the one that kind of describes Rian Johnson, paints the best picture of him, in my opinion, is I think it's his birthday, and he shows up
after like dinner or something, and then he runs through the line of people and high fives everyone. And it's like semi clear that like some people are kind of just like, what, like over it, but some people are into it, but he's just committed to doing that the whole way through, just as awkwardly as possible. And there's something so endearing about that. That's like, this guy is one of us, and he and his best friend are making a Star Wars movie. Like, it just felt so good.
Yeah, there's like nothing about him that's like cool with a capital C. And I think that's amazing. Like, yep. I love him as like, yeah. He's a person whose career I've been following since Brick. And he's always been this kind of like lovely dude, it seems. So to see him make a Star Wars movie, I agree with you. That moment is like really great.
Yeah.
I guess mine, I was just trying to think, what's something we haven't talked about? Cause I've hit so much, but, one thing I thought of was I truly, truly loved the scene where the costume designer, showed, to Rian Johnson, like the successful designs for the Cantabite scene. Mm-hmm. And there's just the moment where he's talking and saying how nervous he was because Rian Johnson wanted something more elegant. It was something they'd never done, so they didn't really have reference to go from. You know, so much of the Star Wars universe, you're going back to Macquarie drawings, you're going back to the original trilogy, or you can even look at the prequels for like, oh, where did that design get inspired, et cetera, et cetera. And he was kind of saying like, this had to be new, this had to feel elegant, you know, and it sounded like some of his early drawings maybe did not meet, you know, the approval of Rian Johnson and the team or something. But I thought that there was a palpable like nervousness that I know in my limited capacity as an artist, like whenever I've shown someone something I've made and just being like simultaneously like confident that it's good, but also really nervous that like, will they like it? Mm-hmm. And there's this moment where Ryan's like watching all these people. He's like going up and being like, oh my God, it's perfect. This is amazing. It's perfect. And that guy starts laughing and they like kind of cut away. And he's just got this like utter like joy and bliss and relief on his face that I was like, oh my God, I know that feeling. I thought it was an amazing moment that they captured.
For me, there's just like a very small moment where, and we kind of, I realized that we didn't give you like a heroic entrance when we were shooting this scene. And when they're filming, he says right before, he's like, it's a turn to camera. Like, that's all it is. Like, there's nothing beyond that where he's like, what you're feeling is, he says it's a turn to camera. And while they're rolling, she turns and he says, pause for applause and cut. And it's just very endearing. And their whole interaction is great.
That reminds me of there was that moment too, where she has the scene with Mark Hamill as Luke when they're reunited. And it was one of those rare moments where you actually see like how it works on set, like just how many people are there. And the fact that like Rian Johnson says, like, everyone's ready, Mark's there, everyone looks perfect. And he's like, okay, Carrie, you let me know when you're ready. And you like hear her so softly say like, okay. And he's like, action, and they roll. And it was just like that moment of like director and actor working together and the whole set clearly like appreciating the importance of like, this is a really tough moment, give them like everything we can to help them, was really cool too. Like it's the other side of that coin. Like you talked about like the sort of levity of that like turn to camera moment. Mm-hmm. And this felt like a very like heartfelt moment. The Carrie stuff was amazing.
A moment that's not nearly as significant, but something that I loved was watching Rian Johnson take a nap in the Millennium Falcon. And it was aspirational to me, even though I'll never have the chance to do that. I'm like, oh, if only one day I could be taking a nap in the Millennium Falcon. I think we're going to leave it there at this moment. I feel like we have so much more that we could talk about with the documentary. There are more special features. Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up one thing that I did really appreciate. I really liked the intro by Clint and Ron Howard. I thought that was great.
Oh, God. Ugh. I also do want to say, watch the deleted scenes, because if you thought what was in the movie was crazy,
Yeah.
You should see what they cut.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Do you think that there's an extended cut out there with Rian Johnson that he would ever release an extended cut? Because it sounded like he wanted a lot of those scenes in the movie.
Yeah. I think there was two scenes that actually were worth keeping in.
The party of the caregivers.
Oh god,
that was great,
insane.
That was hilarious. when they cut to Chewie and R2 yeah. sitting there.
Yeah, they made her spin the lightsaber.
Oh, it was perfect. She's like, oh. The scene where Luke takes a little break and kind of thinks about what's going on.
Mark Skywalker.
Wouldn't that be funny? I mean, it's not too far off from Luke, honestly. Gospel writers. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? Is that them?
There you go.
He's almost Thaddeus, right?
Yeah. That scene, and then also I really liked it. I feel like we didn't get like a good Finn joke the same way we got in Force Awakens when they're working on that gas. When he's like, why did you record that, BB-8? That's weird.
Yeah.
I thought that would have killed in the movie theater.
Yeah, I love that.
Sometimes you gotta get rid of some stuff.
Yeah.
So that will do it for this edition of the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. We will be back shortly. We know we've been off for a while, but we're going to get into a more regular cadence of episodes in the coming weeks as we get ready for Solo, a Star Wars story. So join us next time on the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast.
These are the droids you're looking for.
This is madness.